Hello friends, I'm your host Chris Thrall. I'm a former Royal Marines Commando. I've adventured, for better and sometimes worse, across 80 countries on all 7 continents. Welcome to the Bought the T-Shirt podcast.
Boo, there we are, Lembit, how are you?
Very well, thanks. Very nice introduction. How are you doing? Pleased to be with you, sir.
Yeah, well, I was very pleased to be with you. Was it Sunday we chatted, wasn't it?
That's right. It took an unexpected turn. I thought we were going to talk about military matters in Northern Ireland, but instead we talked about the meaning of life, which perhaps was more important.
Yes, we did. We had a great chat. Also, you gave me a steer for Jacob's Ladder.
Film.
Yeah, I got an hour into it last night.
It's a frightening film. Jacob's Ladder is one of the best films I've ever seen. It's a minor classic. Didn't really get much coverage, perhaps because it's so challenging. But essentially, it talks about coming to terms with who you are. I don't want to spoil the film, but it looks like there's gratuitous violence in it, but all of it is necessary to make the message.
Yes. What I took from it, I think you also gave a quote. I saw that quote on the internet, is... we can end up in purgatory, is it, if we attach too much to the material realm?
Essentially, one of the guides in the film to Jacob, the main character, tells him that it's a paraphrase, but if we fight our situation, then we feel we're surrounded by demons tearing our memories away. But if we let go, we realize they're really angels helping us to the next stage. And I think that it's... very true statement. I've had actually quite an agitating day so far. But yet, when one remembers that the cosmos doesn't really care if you've been in a traffic jam, or if you've bumped your car, or if you've seen £20 fall out of your pocket into the street, it doesn't care, then you can actually be much more at peace with the cosmos. There's something called the Grand Unified Theory, GUT, and it's the... almost the mythical ambition of physics to distill everything into a single formula. If we can do it, that formula has to contain some kind of spirituality too. And then inflation rates and the trivial things we go to war on, this perhaps...
Yes, I'll bet this wasn't a conversation you had back in the day, back in Parliament.
When I was in Parliament, the whole thing seemed to be reduced to superficiality. There were a few great deep people there, people like Mo Mollam, who was the Secretary of State for Northern Ireland, really was an incredible person, and other really smart individuals. And I've met some great thinkers, but by and large, I felt it was inhabited by fairly competent people with a mixture of ambition for being there. Some of them just didn't relate to people very well, and I guess they thought that if they were in charge of people, then they would somehow be able to substitute for that deficiency. Others had this strange arrogance where they assumed that they could run human affairs better than other humans. And well, we see the consequences of that. This country isn't well run at all now. And then there was a third small group of individuals who really had an ambition to, I think, fairly selflessly make a change. They may have had personal ambitions too, but that wasn't the main thing. The greatest politician I ever met was a lady called Benazir Bhutto, who was huge in Pakistan politics. When I met her, I felt that she really was committed to the greater good. She died for it in the end. She was assassinated. Mm. But I really felt something very special with her. So there are some angels amongst, they're not demons, but just amongst the foot soldiers, the people who don't really make a deep impact. They drift into politics, they muck about there and then they leave. But there's few people, they're the ones.
Yeah, politics, it must be a bit like the university system where people graduate, then they do their doctorate, then they become a lecturer, and then they just stay in that kind of, it's not so much a false reality, but it's very shielded from the real world. Do you think that the danger in politics is people go in for all the great intentions, and then they've got to tick this box or sign this paper off to get to the next level, to keep favour with the party?
As with any walk of life, there are opportunities to fall off the path. And politics is fraught with them. I think that people go into politics generally with good intention. Not all of them, but a lot of them do. And what happens is once they get there, they get institutionalized and they discover that in their mind, it's more important to be a politician than to achieve a particular outcome. So they start compromising the mission that took them there in the first place. And it's death by a thousand cuts. Eventually, they just end up being politicians rather than people who want to change the world. One example of that would be Tony Blair and even more so Nick Clegg. Nick Clegg always gave me he was the leader of the Liberal Democrats for a while, and he ruined the party. He always gave me the impression of somebody who just wanted to be in politics. I never got a sense he had any true political compass. And indeed, as soon as he finished, he went off and started earning millions in some big American multinational to do with social media or something. Mm. And he was just an empty vessel. By contrast, take someone like Gerry Adams, who was very big in the Sinn Féin movement, very involved with the IRA, did time his colleagues particularly did time for terrorist acts. They had a mission. They were dedicated to a certain outcome. And when you talk to them, they don't justify what they did. They can explain it. They can explain why they put bombs and shot it, but they can explain it in the context of a narrative. And it's interesting that I found more depth in reformed terrorists than I ever found in Peter Clegg. So it does seem to me that the crucial missing ingredient with so many of these is that deep-seated desire to achieve an outcome. They just want to be in the political process. And I found that ultimately claustrophobic.
Yes. Did you get on well with your constituents, Lembit?
Not in the final election, because they didn't re-elect me. But three times I did. I felt that in the best days, the halcyon days of my time, I was making a difference to individuals. There's a saying, a person who saves one life saves the world. And I think that some of the most important politics, you'd help one individual. That doesn't get into, oftentimes it doesn't get reported anywhere because you stop a bad thing from happening, and that tends not to be very big. But there was a period when I really felt I was able to serve in an effective way those individuals. Though actually, I have to tell you, I enjoyed being a councillor in a local authority in Newcastle upon Tyne more than I enjoyed being an MP. Then I really felt I had a great constituents. There were about 10,000 in the area I represented. I got real things done. They weren't massive things. They were fixing a street, or getting potholes done, fixing somebody's school issue. But for that one person, their education was better for the rest of their lives. I think sometimes what you see in politics is people desperate to make a mark, have a legacy. And if the legacy becomes the outcome, that's a massive thing. If, on the other hand, your mission is to achieve a result and then move on, and that's what I think Mo Molum did when she was Secretary of State for Northern Ireland. She kick-started the peace process pretty much single-handedly. When you've got that, then your legacy may not even, it's almost like an anonymous grave, but it changes things forever. I think Benazir Bhutto, that was her ambition. Gandhi would be another person like that. So many people come and go out of politics, and they don't even really...
It must be hard, because you're up against a lot of greedy, sociopathic type of people. We call them the big club, the cabal, the controllers. I mean, it must be hard to get anything good done, because there must be so much pressure to conform, as we saw with Tony Blair before Iraq, wasn't it? Was it 1 million people marching in London against this conflict or this potential war? And he was still up there, wasn't he? No, we are going to war. And it was really sad that he's never been able to be truthful about the pressure he must have been put under by the Yanks. By the Yanks, I don't mean our dear American brothers and sisters. I mean the, higher apparatus. Do you think a lot of politicians get soul destroyed?
In Blair's case, to use that specific, and then we'll go to the general situation, I like Blair as a person, but once again, he slightly lacked narrative. He was the most successful Labour leader in the history of the party. There's no doubt about it. And he did some good. Things like making museums free again. I never thought that would happen again in this country after the Conservatives allowed an entrance fee. And there were some other good changes he made. And his relationship with Bill Clinton was probably good for the whole world. But what happened to him was he wanted to stay center stage when George W. Bush got elected. So he danced to the tune of a lesser person. I think that Bill Clinton was massively flawed, but he did a lot of good in the Northern Ireland peace process. That's my main interaction indirectly. And so Blair fell into the same trap I described earlier. He wanted to carry on being the big guy, but for everything, there's a season. And his season had passed. And so he ended up duping himself probably into the ridiculous that despite all the evidence that there were weapons of mass destruction, Saddam Hussein had, and he dragged us into a war which killed potentially upwards of 1 million civilians in Iraq. And it was, now moving to the general, it was the poison of egotism, this desire to never let go, the same thing that made Robert Mugabe ruin Zimbabwe, the same thing that initially caused Nelson Mandela trouble, but then he went the other direction and he became comparatively selfless. So I think that there's this demon in politics, this whispering voice saying, don't leave, don't let go, stay, you can be powerful, you can be admired. But it's like a parent who, instead of creating independence in the minds, tries to force them forever dependent upon them. Well, sooner or later, they'll rebel. And I think the real secret of political leadership is to empower people so that they don't, even if they think they do. Blair wanted us to think we needed him, even though we knew we didn't.
Yes. So you're on the journey on the spiritual path, Lembit. The first thing we have to get a control of is our ego, isn't it? And that must be something that is just out of control. I feel like I'm picking on politics. I'm not. It's out of control in society, full stop, isn't it? We reward all the wrong things. If you destroy a rainforest and, you know, make some plastic rubbish, you get an OBE and all this sort of stuff. But if you, you know, work with dispossessed youngsters, or it's not deemed so, it's not deemed so successful.
I suppose I don't like blanket rules. I would say, as a guideline, our society has become more. I think that the whole cult social media means everyone thinks they can be famous because potentially 8 billion people can see a post you put up. So you become famous in your own microcosm. And that, I think, has served to pervert the perception of what really matters. In my book, the most important thing is self-actualization. It's a phrase I became familiar with from a chap called Maslow. Abraham Maslow tried to work out what drives us in the 1940s. And he came up with this pyramid of needs, things that drive us. And he initially said the most empowering thing is self-actualization, basically knowing yourself, seeing the big picture, having the deep and heavy thought, and so on. He later added a spiritual dimension to that too. But below that, there's aspiration for self-esteem. I think that's where people get stuck. If all the basic problems have been fixed, if you're not in physical danger, you've got security, some degree of love and belonging, then you get stuck in self-esteem. So people get obsessed with showing us a picture of their lunch on Facebook. What's all that about? Or I went to an art college recently and everyone was conforming in a non-conformist way and they couldn't see the irony. It's always been present. But now I think that in politics, as you rightly said, the ego is terribly dangerous, creates such a loud noise in people's heads, and they stop recognizing that politics is not, it's more to serve. And the only point of leading is to serve people in a better way. And a lot of people have forgotten that. As I say, Clegg, I return to Clegg all the time because he was really the most dreadful example, a self-seeking egotist I've had to serve under. He was terrible. And if you sat with him now, you might find him reasonably entertaining, but it's kind of carbohydrate conversation. I never really felt he understood anything. The few people who understand things deeply are most admired at times of crisis. When we don't have times of crisis, then the mediocre can rise to the top because the leader, the true leaders, seen as mavericks because they upset the establishment apple.
Yes, I'm fortunate I don't have to work for anyone, although I suppose we all possibly work for someone. But I just remember when I used to have a job, all the people that got promoted up the ladder were all the people I wouldn't trust them to organise a barbecue. I'd ban them from organising a barbecue. I certainly wouldn't want them in charge of anyone. It's a funny system that really rewards people that just have no personality, no life experience, no real skills, no personal touch. They're two-faced creeps. You can tell that I didn't enjoy my last few jobs. Lembit, I just want to bring it back because you weren't really just, like, I don't remember you as a politician. I remember you as a as a bit of a celebrity, which is, you must have been the envy of all the old, you know, fuddy-duddies with their, you know, old school ties and funny shoes, and you've got pop stars on your arm and stuff. What, do you get fed up being asked about this? Or
no, I don't get fed up about it at all. Just one point about the fuddy-duddies, that often, many of them are quite nice people, but inherently, regardless of the party label, a lot of them tend to be conservative minded. Whether you're Labour or Conservative, they're all conservative minded, and so it's hard in peacetime for the maverick to influence. There's a phrase, let chaos reign, then reign in chaos. It's the maverick's motto. But without chaos, we end up in a very constricted situation, and that's where I think we are now. Turning to your comments about me, I was the unintentional celebrity. I've always seen myself as somewhat shy, but it doesn't look like it because I was in all the magazines and all the interviews. But it was because I was drawn there by others. I was pulled there rather than marching there myself. And I found it very flattering. I was really impressed that people wanted to know about me and my relationship, because I was having the, like, a massive deal to me. And you're right, I went out with a cheeky girl, Gabriella, who's a pop star, very big in her day, and her sister Monica. I went out with somebody else, a weather presenter called Sean Lloyd. Now, I hadn't intended to have famous relationships, but it ended up that way. And of course, the media loved it because they thought of me as some geeky politician being taken for a ride by these women. But there was a degree of envy as well, especially with the journalists. Journalists, such an not all of them, but largely an empty, vapid set of parasites who just live vicariously through the people they report. And they don't care of the harm they do. My phone was tapped, I was hacked and everything else. I was libeled. I found out that there's a child on the front page of a terrible newspaper. And I realized then it's a totally double-edged sword. You're supping with the devil when you're with the media. And so when they like you, they big you up, but then they knock you down because that'll sell a few. And I still feel the scars because I think that my life was diverted in an unhealthy direction, maybe for a decade, maybe even longer, by the seduction of fame. Did I enjoy it at the time? A little, yeah. Do I miss it? A little. But I never hungered for it one way or the other. You see, others who get addicted to power, and I've described some of it already, others get addicted to fame, and they think that fame is going to solve their problem. All fame does, turbocharge your problem, and sometimes perhaps the reward. I'm not surprised that many of the really famous people have addiction and problems of depression, because they live in a goldfish, get time to process. And I'll say one more thing. In Parliament, what I noticed is that my emotional match stalled. While I was in that instant grow, I became more experienced, but didn't grow as an individual. That restarted after I left Parliament. So if you're in Parliament for 30 years, you've probably more or less got the, and that's not usually enough to...
Same as the military, Lembit, isn't it? We discussed this yesterday. You get these colonels that are 50-odd years old, and they still haven't worked out the war lie, that nobody benefits from that nonsense, that the taxpayer loses all their hard-earned money through naivety, and that millions get massacred, or potentially millions get massacred. I guess when you're in a kind of sheltered environment, there's no pressure on you to evolve as a human being. Does that sound right?
Yeah, it's the institutionalized environment. It's like a great big boarding school where instead of spending till you're 18 there, you can spend till you're 80 there or longer. And so I think that the human development gets shelved because you learn how to debate in a clever way in a house. You learn how to schmooze people. You learn how to sound like you know a lot about something you don't know. But the pain of everyday life, the worry about not paying your mortgage, all that's gone. And you can have your affair with your secretary or whatever. There's a whole subculture, which has always been there, of that kind of thing. So you can carry on essentially being an adolescent for most of your life. And if you're like that, by the time you're probably not going to. And remember, these people are making the whole country. So if you have children in Parliament, they'll make childish decisions. And I think war is a childish decision. One other example, which I think is unforgivable, is that all the parties seem to coalesce into saying no to a ceasefire in Gaza. And then we see that of the 34,000 plus people who've been killed, at least 32,000 combatant women and children and men who never have picked up arms. But these people, because they don't feel, say, oh, no to a ceasefire. And if you criticize Benjamin Netanyahu, you're anti-Semitic. No, you're not. You just think he's a terrible politician and he's presided over the deaths of lots of innocent.
Plus, you're allowed to be anti-Semitic if you don't like Jewish people. That it is a free world. And we have been led down a path where we're not even allowed our own we're not even allowed our own thoughts. I think the whole Jewish thing is going to it's blowing up in their face, because I think people are just fed up with, you know, I think they're fed up with being fed narratives and told what you are and what you're not allowed to think. And you have good people and you have people that aren't helpful, and it's fine to, you know, not even sure what the words I'm looking for, but you know, you're allowed to think about them, come to your own conclusions.
You're allowed to have different views. One of the things that we've done is the woke agenda, which started off with noble intent in the 20s and 30s, 1920s, 1930s, which is about being aware of your cultural surroundings. It's been completely hijacked so that actually it's the woke agenda, which is intolerant and discriminatory. You should be allowed to criticize Benjamin Netanyahu without being accused of being anti-Semitic. And the double standards are like this. No one went around saying Tony Blair's got an illegal war going on in Iraq, but that's what you get with Catholics like Tony Blair. And so there are double standards there as well. And then turning to this thorny issue of what's acceptable, in my view, everything is. I'm fundamentally a libertarian. And if somebody wants to tell me why they don't like the Jewish faith, I will have that conversation. I'm interested. Mm. I'll ask them why. And why they've got issues about Muslim faith or atheism. I've got issues with atheism. If I'm allowed to raise those issues, atheism is clearly a religion. The bar to prove the non-existence of a creator is higher than accepting that there must have been a cause to the universe. But I want to be able to have that debate without being accused of being discriminatory. And I don't mind if people disagree with my spiritual views. The answer I give them is, good, you see it differently. Help me understand your view, and maybe I'll learn something from it. But now what we've done is we've created a situation, Chris, where nobody's allowed to say that, and you get isolated. The other religion at the climate emergence, I can talk about the science of it if you want. My concern is you're not allowed to. There are lots of people who say that wrecking the climate. Well, I want to have that debate. I want to share my data. But instead, in our cancel culture, you're regarded as a heretic if you don't conform to the, in my view, scientifically illiterate belief that human beings generate enough carbon dioxide to affect the climate in a measurable way. My issue is the debate. You can't have it. And that's the danger. We're in a Spanish Inquisition situation or a Soviet system where if you don't go with the orthodox, then you're cast out.
Yes, we should touch on, I don't want to get, I wanted to chat with you as a mate. And I think it's great you're on the spiritual path, because it's all I ever bang on about. It's all your answers to life therein lie. But I think our audience at the moment, there's a lot of upset people out there about the immigration. I say it's planned destruction of Europe. We've talked about this a lot on my show. A lot of people think it's just incompetent politicians. Do you have any take on it, Lemby?
Yeah, this is another area that you get accused of being racist if you complain about. My parents, both from Estonia, they had to leave that country because they would have been killed if they'd stayed in the Soviets. Let's make no mistake, of course, we aligned with Joseph Stalin, the biggest murderer in the history of the human race, 75 million killed by him. But he was an ally, so we don't really talk about that. Members of my family fell victim to Stalin. So I'm very grateful to the fact that the United Kingdom welcomed my parents as children and their parents, because otherwise I would never have existed. The problem is we don't have a strategy. This country doesn't decide really who to let in. It just decides to make the judgment. If you've got the initiative to get down to Calais, you've got a good chance of getting across this country. But think about it this way, Chris. If you're wealthy and you know somebody has a boat, then sail up to Hartlepool and get off there, because no one's going to stop you. And then the next step beyond that, if you happen to be wealthy and you have £10 million, you can buy your way in. No one's going to stop you. The big problem here is that we have Labour and Conservative, who are virtually indistinguishable on all the key issues, who have been completely paralysed by fear of being accused of being racist. They did something about the boats. What would I do about the boat people? It's not beyond the wit of humanity to have, for example, drones or aircraft patrolling the channel, identifying everything that's coming across day or night. I know a man called John Beckner who's got a satellite system, but we don't do it. And so we presided over the largest net immigration, 700,000 people in 2023 in the history. And it's because, Chris, politicians just don't dare tackle. Australia has. They've got a point system. I think that makes sense. They also happen to have lots of ocean, but we could do it. Even now, today, before I came on, I heard that the government's admitting they don't know where a lot of the people they want to send to Rwanda actually are. That is how pathetic our immigration control system is. It isn't a control system. It's an out of...
Yes. Good. Glad we clarified that. Can we talk about Estonia? Absolutely beautiful country. I had the pleasure of flying to, is it Tallinn? Forgive me. I flew into, this is talking 25 years ago now. We spent a whole day. We had our cycle panniers as our sort of carry-on luggage on the plane. It's all we had. And we spent the whole day going around Tallinn looking for secondhand bikes that we could hop on. And someone said, why don't you try the supermarket? So we went to the supermarket, and for about half the price, we were looking at secondhand bikes. You could buy these really good, brand new mountain bikes. So we bought one each and cycled across Estonia and then into Latvia and then finished Lithuania. Yes, fascinating. This is another thing as well. And I'm just not trying to sound like lord it over people that haven't travelled, but it really does help you to kind of see life, doesn't it? When you're in Estonia and you can see the Soviet influence, the kind of bunker-like buildings, and you can almost sort of see the way history's shaped and the way it affects people. And were you born there? I was born in
Northern Ireland to Estonian parents.
Yes, of course.
They had to come out from there. My grandfather was an astronomer and he settled at Armagh Observatory, which is one of the big globally recognized astronomy. My father was a physicist, physics and applied maths at Queen's University Belfast. And so we settled there and my mum and dad had me and raised 2 decades of my life. And it was a troubled place. But then so was, you're right how you describe Tallinn. Tallinn is a country capital. The population of Tallinn is actually of Estonia. It's very similar to Northern Ireland. And there are many similarities, even in terms of size. Estonia and Northern Ireland, certainly the island of Ireland, are very comparable in size and actually agrarian sort of history as well. But I recognize now more than as a child that I have a very strong Estonian heritage. English is my second language. Estonian is my first. Obviously, my name's Estonian. What I'm wondering is whether there's a relationship between Estonia and the UK that could tell us a lot more about how countries can get on. Estonia fought a war of independence against Germany and Russia at the same time and won it. And Estonia was helped by the UK. The UK lost 119 servicemen that war. No one knows about it, apart from Estonians all. And they really respect the fact that a big country did the right thing. There wasn't really much to help UK. There wasn't really much in it for the UK. But it was one of those times when the UK did the right thing, all countries. It's the complete antithesis of what we did in Afghanistan and Iraq. Mm. We actually did the right thing for a small country instead of doing the wrong thing in 2 big ones.
Are they in NATO yet?
Yes. I have major doubts about that. It's too late. They have been in a while. They didn't join recently. They've been in for a while. But that's because they didn't want to be invaded by Russia again. Estonia lost a large proportion of its population and also had a lot of homogenization where there was forced moving of Russian to Estonia to try to break the culture. And the same thing happened in Latvia and Lithuania. But two remarkable things have occurred there. Number one, culture of all 3 Baltic states has remained largely. And number two, there was no bloody revolution. They had a singing, they sang there through folk songs, a million person line of people holding hands from across all 3 Baltic states, which somehow caused the breakdown of Soviet control. I'm paraphrasing, saving time, but it's a remarkable example of how you can have a peaceful change. And that's what my own life experience, and probably a slight melancholy, which I sense in my soul, is probably carried the dark times of my own family. But it probably also informed me, maybe that's why I was never so the fame and the razzmatazz and the power. I can see what power does. Power is only, it's a currency. Money doesn't make you happy, helps you to do things. Power doesn't, can help. And then that's back tied in my view. If you don't have a spiritual decisions, you're always with darkness, because in an atheist world, there is no.
Yes, it's that trying to find pleasure and externalizing power lies. It's like, it's a bit like religion, really. When you sort of worship a deity or a statue, you're overlooking the fact that the divinity is within you. You're a microcosm of this incredible universe. Well, Lembit, was there a single kind of driving factor in you seeking this path? I can't remember if I mentioned it on your show, but for me, it was just the absolute depths of addiction. I couldn't really go any lower unless I died. And in that moment, I just had an epiphany. I suddenly saw the way I've been living my life was just so wrong. It was so wrong. And those couple of tweaks I mentioned, you know, Chris, stop playing the victim. Get out there and smash it. And appreciate this life, because a lot of my Marine buddies were dead by this stage through various mishaps, most of them horrendous. It's the thing, what would they give to be here now? They wouldn't be sat bloody in squalor looking forward to the next hit of whatever. And I woke up the next day, Lembit, my life was different, and it's always been like that. I had this like ready breath glow that I knew everything was all right and I was all right and it was all going to be fine.
When I was 12, I started exploring concepts of spirituality, and I was interested. I've never been an atheist. I've never thought there is no God. But when I was 12, I interested in the subject, and there's a very specific conversation I had with my father. We were in the car going from Bangor, which is where I was born, to Belfast. We were driving, a very specific memory, driving through a tree corridor where the trees were overhanging and the sun was coming in. I guess it was late spring. And we were talking about something called the second law of thermodynamics, which is actually quite a depressing law. It's the law which says that essentially everything descends into chaos. It's a necessary law, because that's why hot flows to cold, why charge goes from one place to another. It's a thing that makes it possible for things to happen in the universe, but it's also a sad thing, but eventually the universe will end up dead. And we were talking about this, I was 12. And I said to my father, do you believe in God? And he looked out the window and he said, yes, I do. And I said, why as a physicist in God? He said, because to think all this is an accident, a shame. Mm. And I needed no further persuasion. And it seemed so obvious to me that his answer was correct, that there had to be a purpose. Couldn't just be an accident, as the atheists, in my view, rather naive or superficially claim. And then a few days later, I saw something considered to be a miracle. And to this day, I believe that I came to the conclusion that my reward was a higher power marking. The miracle was going, welcome on board. I never doubted it. I wouldn't say that I'm into orthodoxy, but I have no doubt at all that whatever it is that spiritual people believe in religion, it's essentially the same. And that life is where our anchored, and I suspect our
Am I right in thinking we're both pilots?
Yes.
Yes.
I've got a pilot's license. Yes. Not current now. Can't afford it now. I've got children. But yeah.
I took mine in the States, so it's always current. I pulled a sneaky one there. You've got to obviously do a check test when you go over there. But you came very close to not being here, didn't you? Hang on, I wrote this down.
I can tell you, we can save time. It was a paragliding accident.
Yeah, paragliding accident. You broke your back in 12 places, and your ribs, and your sternum, and your jaw. That was a bad day, wasn't it?
April the 13th, 1998. I was paragliding with a friend called Rob Burridge, and we always used to have this competition on who could get into the sky first. It's a windy day, a big mountain in Wales. And I opened my camera, swept up straight away. It's far, far too dangerous. Even if I was true, absolute maestro, I'd have probably... I was intermediate in terms of my competence. Well, I think that I did something which is technical, stalling the canopy. I think I stalled the canopy. Essentially meant it just wasn't working like a wing anymore. And I fell about 30 meters, the size of a pretty big skyscraper, vertically, right down. I wouldn't have reached what you would call terminal velocity, because then it would have been a terminal situation. So it must have given me a little bit of braking, but I hit the ground absolutely vertically, hard enough to smash my 12 vertebrae, I crushed my sternum with my jaw, which then broke. Lots of other damage. Nearly died. And that could have been a quadriplegic, could have been a paraplegic, incontinent. I could have been dead. But it wasn't my day to die. And I had a near. I think it changed my mind, aware of the fact that the meaning of life is in itself. Mm. I think that's perhaps why I have the views I do about politics, because people seem to think that getting to is a result. It's a title. It doesn't make you bigger in the eyes of an alien coming down to Earth. Couldn't tell a prime minister apart from. And I think that I started thinking more seriously about all of that. I'd been an MP for years. I think ever since that, I knew even then on that day and during that experience that it would carry on changing. The changes still happen. And I suppose this year, I feel that I'm back on. Just remember, finite we are. and can have all the money in the world. I think it was one of the monarchs of Britain who said her dying words, all my kingdom, the breath. I prefer to think, I'll have the breaths, I'm entitled, I'll be interested in what's next, liberating. And you've been there. My low point, physiological, your low point, also physiological. Essentially, it doesn't matter what the details are. The mission is the same. And one of the tragedies, perhaps one of the ironies, those who don't experience those kind of traumatic, challenging moments are almost robbed to make the right decision.
Yes, we covered this on your show, didn't we? If you love a mundane life, there isn't a lot of learning in it. It's only through hardship you get the learning that puts you in paradise. And so I'm often saying to embrace the hardship. There will be better days to come, but I don't know if people get into paradise by having an easy life.
I think heaven and hell are the same place. I think that it's our ability to manage the next stage which defines whether we find it heavenly or hellish. It's an issue which is slightly touched on, like the ladder that you mentioned. If I think about my life, so many problems before talking, and yet if I was living in Gaza, seen my family incinerated by another murderous attack, my neighborhood, and somebody said, let's rewind by one day and you can have Lembit Opik's life and his family problem, his financial challenge and all the things, would you take it? And I think that's the thing that teaches. It was Richard Nixon, who was actually very impressive and president, who was pulled down for a misdemeanor, which these days probably wouldn't even move the dial compared to what I've seen in politics. But Richard Nixon said it's only through walking through the shadows in the valley that truly appreciates on the high mountain. You have to walk through the dark. And some of the people who are most cursed on this planet are the ones who never want for anything. They've got essentially limitless funds, an easy education, a shoe-in job, almost a prearranged holidays, and they don't stare down the barrel of bankrupt or addiction or physical hardship or isolation. So they never get... I was swimming this. It's tiring. But unless you exit...
I would say I ran up a big hill this way. I cheated.
At least you tried. At least you went up.
Just say to my people out there, just get out and just gentle jog, walk around the block, do something to get those endorphins flowing and get us back to our human state. I've got one last thing, Lembit, because I probably never get the chance to ask anyone this again, although I did have a chopped salmon for a year in a Norwegian fish factory. And up there, one of our bosses appeared on the program that they call Vil du bli millionaire. And I know that in this country, we call it
Who wants to be a millionaire?
I don't watch TV, so I almost forgot the name of it. But I have seen my favourite ever scenario in it was the one where the guy gets to the end. He's got all his lifelines left. He's got one question to make the million. And he phones his dad and he says, hi, Dad, I'm a millionaire. Puts the phone down. But I am right in thinking you have appeared on the celebrity version.
Yes, I did.
How was it?
I did with my then partner, Sean Lloyd, the weather presenter. Okay. Very nerve-wracking because we were raising the money for charity. We didn't get to keep the money, which is fine. And we got to 64,000 and Sean actually had the next question right. 28,000 we'd have had, but
the question?
Who wrote Saturday Nights? Do you know who it was?
I was the author.
Yeah, who's the author?
What, they want that bit as well?
Who was the author? Yeah.
I don't know.
Solito. And she thought that it was, and I couldn't help her because I just... So we banked the money. Otherwise, we'd have gone back to 32,000 if we'd been wrong. And it's, you'd think, well, it's just in for a penny. It doesn't matter. It's not our money. But you don't feel that way. You really do become totally engaged and totally invested. And so we made 64,000, 32,000 for her charity, for mine, on diseases. The charity was trying to cure the disease of my father. And it was quite a privilege to show. I've done a lot of them. I've done one, I'm a Celebrity, Get Me Out of Here, Where You Live in the Jungle, Australia.
That's the other one that there used to be one program that I would watch. It was the only thing, and it was I'm a Celebrity. It's because I love the human dynamic. I love to watch people rucking up against each other, having some real obstinate person. Yeah. And then as they do the forming, the storming and the norming, they all start to appreciate each other and accept each other's differences and further each other's skills. And the person that ends up winning it very often is not the person that you think. Did you went to Australia for this? Yeah.
Yeah. To the rainforest, which is about 160 kilometers south of Brisbane. It's a real rainforest, and you're probably about 15 miles from the nearest big road. There are no towns. You don't go to nearby. You don't go to a hotel at night. You really are living under the stars. And under massive torrential rain every day. What I loved, and they didn't know, I love camping. I really enjoyed doing camping. It's one of my hobbies. And so I enjoyed it. But a lot of the others didn't. Nigel Havers walked out, couldn't stand it. Other people, very, very precious. Jenny Eclair disgraced herself by using powerful negative language behind my back about me. So I don't see it funny to be really rude about people. But I met some great people there too. Sean Ryder from a band called The Happy Mondays. Lovely
guy. You in that? You were in that series?
Yeah, it was at that time the most watched series.
Yeah, I apologies. It was so, my brain's getting a bit grey now, but I remember.
It's 2010, 14 years ago. Who would remember?
Well, I remember Sean got bit by that bloody, looked like a cobra.
Yeah, well, it was a python. And actually, you can't see it on the screen, but I actually was bitten by it first. I was the first person to ever be bitten by a snake on the station. He was bitten 20 minutes later by the same snake. I told him, don't put your hand in the box. It'll bite you. He did. And he made much more noise about it. I just sucked it up. Yeah. Sean was much, much more a celebrity value in how he reacted. And that was the one. So Sean and I became close friends, good friends to this day. Cheryl Gascoigne, the football widow, she was there, good friend, many others as well. So I've done that. I've done lots of celebrity television, but it is celebrity TV. It's called reality TV, but that's ironic because it's very far from reality. I do recognize it has a role. Entertainment has a role. And I don't belittle it, and I don't begrudge the consequences of sometimes being seen as a lightweight. It's all part of the journey. And Chris, the privilege of having been on the show, only a few hundred people have ever gone from the UK to do a celebrity get me out of here. And I was considered enough as a celebrity to know the first former MP in the history of the show. But in some ways, it's an allegory to what we started with. None of it's that important. And people get the idea that being a great victor, a celebrity TV show is all that matters. Just doesn't. What matters is what you learn along the way. When you're dust in the ground, when you're recycled by worms, the worms don't care. They don't say, oh, we're eating the celebrity. But maybe the unmarked legacy behind, that's what matters. I like to think when we die, we have at least some opportunity to play it for what we ahead. And perhaps for those who don't take that seriously, sincerely and in good faith, when they play forward the tragedies they create, perhaps that is the...
I've got someone who wants to say hello to you. The gentleman by the name of Hank McGregor.
Hank McGregor. We did a single together.
He's holding a band. I believe it. He looks American, so I'm guessing it's a banjo.
He's not American. He's Scottish.
That is just as bad.
Weekend Rock and Roll Band. We put a single out called Weekend Rock and Roll Band, and Hank and I performed it at Macmillan Cancer Relief Palace of Variety when I was there. There's a famous photograph of me and Hank in a leather jacket, and Hank looking very cool. It was a really cool shot. And that single went out there, Weekend Rock and Roll Band, and I play harmonica. My goodness, that's a blast from the past. Hank, I hope you're doing all right. I can tell you this now because it was long ago. There was a very posh dinner afterwards in, I think, the Savoy Hotel. Hank had nowhere to stay. The next morning, I called Hank, said, are you all right? He said, yeah. Where did you stay? He said, I stayed in the Savoy. I said, in the Savoy? He said, yeah, I slept under the grand piano. Nobody noticed because there was a sheet over it. So Hank McGregor stayed in the largest room in the Savoy after we'd performed for charity.
I meant to say at the start of this podcast for you, Lembit, and our friends at home, the reason I'm looking like this, folks, is I'm trying to control the chat and put up the interesting comments and show some pictures, da-da-da-da. Some people see it and they think that I'm just being ignorant. They think like I've just lost interest in my guest. But
you need a production team, that's all.
Yes. And we should give a shout out to TNT Radio because that's where we met. They've been very kind. I've been on their show, about four times, I think, in the last fortnight. And it's never the conversation with me that the presenter thinks it's going to be. I think they all think it's going to be a bit more military industrial complex, where it's a bit more Mother Teresa.
Well, yes, MIC, as opposed to, was it NIB, New English Bible, is that right?
Yes.
But it's all in the round. Everything's put in the soil for us to use or to misuse, and it's down to us what we do. People don't seem to understand. When they talk about the problem of evil, how can there be a God if there's a problem, if there's evil? Well, think about it. If there's no evil, there's no good. There has to be choice. If you're pre-programmed to be good, you're not being good, you're just following a program. And the miracle of consciousness, and perhaps for another time, because it's a huge discussion, the fact that we do seem to have agents, we can make sense. I don't really are fooled into this. I think we genuinely have free.
Absolutely.
And that's where this debate is interesting. We didn't have to war again and again and on. We don't have to get angry.
Lembit, please stay on the Zoom just so I can thank you properly after I hit the record off. I just got to play us out. Not before I've said a massive thank you to a super wonderful chap from a super guy. Thank you so much. I just want to give a personal message from me. Friends, if you can please make sure you're liked and subscribed, that would be great. And also, can I just say a massive thank you to everyone that supported my transatlantic row, which will be in December. I will be rowing across the Atlantic Ocean to shine a light for veterans and anyone else who's struggling with their mental health. My message is, I've been there. I know what it's like. Don't forget, you're born perfect and you are massively, massively loved, way more than you know. And there are better days to come. Thanks to everyone who's chucked £5 in the pot. Really, really kind of you. Thank you. And yes, that's it. Lembit, I'll chat to you in a second. Massive thank you again. Much love, everyone.
Friends, thank you for listening to the Bought the T-Shirt podcast. Please like, subscribe and share. And don't forget to follow me on social media. Username, Chris Thrall. Instagram, Chris.Thrall. Thank you.